So, are you all sitting comfortably? Because here we begin. So, it's the last one tonight, the last of the six. Thank you so much for joining me on this journey. It's been great for me because I've really had to do a lot of work to find out more about this subject because it's very dear to my heart, but I'm relatively new to it. So, part six of Reclaiming the Divine Feminine. And this time we're going into magic and mystery. But we're going to look at trying to sum up what we've been talking about these last 6 weeks and what the divine feminine actually represents to a human being. And I think we can see from the Bible stories in the last 2 weeks that it can be summed up by not trying harder, rather learning to resist less. It's about allowing the flow. There's that famous phrase, going with the flow. But the divine feminine would be watching with the flow and rowing half a mile an hour faster than the river. That's the careful way of doing it. You go with the flow, but you make quite sure that you are in control of your ship as well, of your boat, so you can get round any obstacles and don't end crashing up on the side of rocks. And then, of course, I'm going to contradict myself immediately by saying the divine feminine is also asking for help and then taking your hands off the steering wheel. So I've definitely contradicted myself, but that's the great paradox about the divine feminine. It's this and it's that. It's yes and. So if we ask God for help, then we have to let go of the problem, just like Hannah did in the story. She went to the temple and said, "Help me, give me a child," and then stop worrying about it. So in that respect, they're quite different, but they seem to be very similar. So you have to ask for help and certainly watch what signs are coming and watch which way you're going, but allow the help to come in the way the divine is going to offer it to you, because that's always going to be better than what you want yourself because you don't have the bigger picture. The divine feminine is not into immediate gratification. That is a combination of toxic masculinity and toxic femininity. This idea of just giving yourself a quick hit so you don't have to do the discipline of work. And of course, during the lockdowns that we've been experiencing this last year, a lot of us have been hitting Netflix and binge watching things. And they're a very good way of taking your mind off subjects, but they're not a good way of sorting any kind of issues. So the divine feminine will always err on the side of doing things slowly and steadily and properly. The divine feminine also is willing to face the fear of the unknown. It's willing to deal with the chaos. Remember Tiamat, the first goddess in Babylon who was beaten by Marduk? She represented the chaos. What seems to be this formless swirling which has no pattern, but in fact the pattern is just bigger than we can conceive of. So to us it seems to be chaos, but all aspects of it are pulling together in order to create something. Also realizing we don't always need to understand fully. One of Caroline Mace's strictures is that a lot of people don't heal because they have to know the reason why they got sick. And that's very human. And one does want to know, but unless we can let go of that desire to know everything, we're going to control too much of our lives. It's going to be like rowing uphill. Up the stream, not uphill, you don't row uphill, but rowing upstream instead of allowing the river to take you downstream but guiding your own craft. Valuing knowledge and experience over information. Information is the blessing and the curse of the modern day. We have far too much information out there and we tend to pick up on it and run with it. Again, it's immediate gratification. I can get more information now, whereas the divine feminine is always about how can I experience this? How can I live it? How can I make it part of me? How can I take it in? Because it's information plus experience which equals knowledge. And also the divine feminine is the power of no, a gentle, strong no. Enough. That's it. No, we stop now. And of course, the divine feminine is Mother Nature. And she teaches us that death and rebirth are entirely normal, nothing to be feared. Humans have forgotten that. She teaches us that the universe and all life operate in patterns and cycles. That's why things like astrology and tarot and human design work, because they log in to the perennial tradition and the patterns of creation. Yes, we humans have got free will, but we really don't use it quite as much as we think we do. It also teaches us that some days you eat and other days you get eaten. Everything works out in its pattern. And if you're not meant to eat that day, then you will be fed the next day. The Divine Feminine will always take care of you if you don't run amok and if you don't take too much. She teaches us that beauty is everywhere, certainly in nature. Nothing real can be hurried. That's a little bit like not having the instant gratification, but she's okay with the process of things. She's okay with the taking time. She absolutely understands that spirit is a vital part of the dynamic. And without spirit, nothing is going to work out perfectly. And spirit, of course, is always part of the uncertainty. And that misery is an important signal that we're off course. It is not something to be drugged away. The toxic feminine drugs away our misery. And of course, you can drug yourself with the Netflix hit, but the actual antidepressants, which are very necessary sometimes, but should never be there forever. The idea of an antidepressant is to retrain the brain how to use serotonin and the other good feel-good aspects. It's not to completely drug you out of life. I've been counselling a lady recently whose husband killed himself, and she was talking about the effect of the antidepressants he was taking and how he killed himself when they upped the dose, which actually allowed him to feel for a while, because she said he had been spending the last month since going on the antidepressants feeling nothing. No anger, no grief, no pain, no pleasure, just an everyday stable okayness. And that's not life. That's not life. Life in all its pains and its agony is meant to be lived. So when we drug away our misery and we won't face it, that means we're never going to get into that boat to row down the river and steer with our paddle. And the other most important thing, which religion has contradicted so seriously for so long, that no one form of life is any more important than any of the others. So where and when did we lose all this? Well, we know that we lost a lot of it back in the time of the Bible, but we also lost a lot of it thanks to people like this beautiful lady on page 4, who is a genuine witch. Her name is Susie Crockford, and she and I do a podcast together called Wise Women, the Vicar and the Witch, and we're very good friends, and it's lovely to talk with each other. And to start with, it was a little bit difficult, but once we got our language sorted, it was absolutely beautiful, because this woman knows the land and loves the land. Now, the problem is that witches have been tarred with something called the Malleus Maleficarum, which was published in 1487, just at the time that the printing press came out, and everything that went on the first printing presses really got set in stone because people were so excited by it, and people thought if it was written down it was absolutely true. And Heinrich Kramer, who wrote this, he was a German Catholic clergyman, got it out with 29 printings, I mean, second only to the Bible, which also says you shan't suffer a witch to live, though the Hebrew word is more like accurately poisoner. So in the Middle Ages, this divine feminine became tarred with the brush of evil. And it probably happened because the feminine is the part of us that sees to the birthing and the dying. We know that most nurses are female, even nowadays. Most doctors are masculine, but most nurses are feminine. There's this caring aspect of the nurturing into life and into death. And when you're trying to control people, you don't want the magical or the mystical. Certainly the church doesn't want the magical or mystical, because the magical and mystical tells you exactly what happened when Jesus died on the cross, that the veil of the temple is torn and that we have our direct contact. And if we have our direct contact, we don't need the priests. And speaking as a priest, I think that's an excellent idea, not to need us. The idea is to show you the way for yourself so that you can get on with your life without having to turn up and get another hit from us, because that's drugging you out of your own self-empowerment as well. Anyway, this book, Malus Maleficarium, outlined the three criteria that made a witch: evil intentions, the help of the devil, and the permission of God, because witches, he thought, could only do their wicked work if God wanted to punish bad people. Witches couldn't hurt the pious. So why one wanted to get rid of witches gets a little bit confusing, really. Surely they were doing God's work, but no. Thousands and thousands of people, mostly women, not all women, were accused of being witches and either had to deny it and give up all their herbal lore and go to church regularly on Sundays, or they would be tested as a witch, which meant being floated or drowned or all sorts of other little strange tortures like sticking needles in you. And if you failed the test, you were burnt. Sometimes you were killed before you were burnt, but mostly it was a fairly nasty death. And witches, well, indigenous people throughout history have had beliefs about spirits, and people have always believed that there was power in herbs. And they weren't called witches until it was the contact with Western ideas. Usually they were called the cunning folk or the wise folk. And they didn't always have negative connotations at all. They were the herbalists and healers. Jesus's mother, the wife of the carpenter, who would have been the equivalent of the Nazareth doctor, certainly the Nazareth surgeon, because the carpenter knew how to handle knives and blades and axes and would be the one who'd have to do an amputation. And his wife would be the herbalist, the healer. She would have to, at the very least, know how to administer poppy seed syrup, which we would call opium, or we would call heroin, or we would call morphine, for whenever somebody needed some serious work done. And it's entirely likely that Mary, Mother of Jesus, was a herbalist, therefore, technically, a witch. Now, Ronald Hutton, the Professor Ronald Hutton, who's in TV shows a lot talking about this kind of thing, the Middle Ages and witchcraft, has said in his book, The Witch, that the word witch in the Middle Ages simply came to connotate an evil doer. So that's why the panic took off. You just tarred all women and all herbalists as potential witches. And the hysteria around it was ridiculous, as you will have heard of or read or seen in the Salem witch trials. So this book, the Malus Maleficarium, taught how to prosecute witches, and it just spread this cancer of destroying the divine feminine. And this wasn't just Europe, though Europe really picked it up and ran with it. Many women in South America were killed by witch hunt, and the exact number really isn't known because there wasn't much record keeping, and there are all sorts of different opinions about time frames, about regions that should be included, and the entire persecuting legal system, judges, ministers, priests, constables, jailers, judges, doctors, prickers, torturers, jurors, executioners, were nearly all male, and the victims were overwhelmingly female. And quite often, sometimes they were just what we would literally call a witch hunt. There wasn't any paperwork done whatsoever. And they are considered by a lot of people to be called what you call gynocide, i.e. genetic or homicide. In the documentary The Burning Times, a lady called Thea Jensen called this period in history a woman's holocaust. So the church had a lot to do with that, but so did this sort of equivalent of social media shaming that we have today. It's not that much different. It's just that people were put to death, whereas nowadays celebrities can be shamed so much that they take their own lives. It's similar. And the human nature, unfortunately, when it is locked into toxic femininity more than a toxic masculine, will destroy the magic because it shows us up. If there is a wise woman, then she is wiser than us. If there is a healer, she can change us, and we don't want to be changed. We really, really don't. And it was basically an attempt to control the power of life and death, which was meant to be in the hands of God, according to the church. And of course, it was made worse with what we call the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, when we came into rationality. And all of this stuff, okay, the witches weren't persecuted so much, it was just dismissed. And you see this now in the media and TV and movies. So often anything holistic or spiritual is just dismissed as ridiculous and rubbish, because mocking something is actually more powerful than killing it. Because if you kill people, you get martyrs. But if you mock them, you just make idiots out of them. So that's basically the story of the witches. I don't want to go into any more of that. It was a pretty terrible time. And we're not really that much better now. The phrase witch hunt has gone into legend. But what we lost with this was so powerful and so beautiful. You've got some of the quotation I'm going to read out loud to you now on slide number 5, but this is all of it. And I don't know who wrote it, but the picture and the words are on the website on slide number 5, so you can look them up for yourselves. And the beautiful quotation is, they told you about the contractions, but did they tell you about the expansion? Did they tell you how your body would open to make way for the whole universe to pass through it? Did they tell you how your heart would explode with a love bigger than anything you've ever known as you put your baby to your chest? They told you about the ring of fire, but did they tell you about the crown of stars? Did they mention there's a moment when your baby enters the world and you leave your body and touch the heavens and become the light of a million galaxies? Did they tell you how the pain of stretching to receive your child would be more exquisite than any sensation you've ever felt? They told you you'd scream, but did they tell you about how you would roar? Did they tell you about the power that would rise up from your belly as you called your baby forth with your mighty voice? Did they tell you how you would embody the wild woman within you as you breathe fire with your song? They told you you would bleed, but did they tell you that sacred blood wouldn't scare you? How you would feel grateful and wondering for that magical liquid of life as it trickled down your leg. How you would honour its flow and how it would help you heal a lifetime of hating your body's bleeding cycle. They told you these stories. They taught you to fear birth, to fear your power, to fear yourself. But you are stronger and wiser than that, Mama. You know that birth is your divine dance, your soul's song, your moment with God, and you walk fearlessly into her open arms. So what we lost? Well, we lost the knowledge that we're one with all creation. We forgot that if we're going to have dominion over everything that lives, that also means you have responsibility for. The phrase noblesse oblige was taught always to the British aristocracy. And noblesse oblige was, when you have privilege and power, you must use it for the good of those who are weaker than you. Obviously, it wasn't always used, but that is the principle that is taught. We forgot the perennial wisdom traditions, the magic, the myth, the power of myth. We forgot that the feminine autonomy in both men and women over death and life was a healing and life-affirming law. We forgot about reincarnation. We hid it because reincarnation is part of the divine feminine of resurrection, death and resurrection. And we forgot that the order to be fruitful and multiply, that's rabba, which means to become great, not necessarily more, might just be a little old-fashioned in a world with billions of humans who are pushing out the animals. We may need to reconsider that one. And we learnt to fear chaos and to insist on controlling it and outnumbering it. And if we're going to heal ourselves on this planet, we need to regain all of that. Because the divine feminine is all about ecology. The ecology of this planet. This planet will not heal unless we work with harmonic resonance. And harmonic resonance is based on the perennial wisdom tradition of our ancestors, and it's that age-old knowledge that all plants, all animals, all nature have attendant intelligence. That we need to relate to subtle beings that are responsible for the growth and the well-being of the vegetable and animal realms. That every single thing that lives has its own angel, even if it's the tiniest angel. And harmonic resonance is when we identify with the planet and speak with the spirits of the grass and the trees and the sky and the moon and the air, because we've forgotten to do that. And just because they don't speak back in our language doesn't mean to say they're not trying to communicate, because they are. Very first time I looked at Saturn through a really good telescope, I was absolutely amazed, because that planet was looking back. And that sounds ridiculous, but I can't explain it other than knowing that Saturn was observing me observing Saturn. And of course, that wasn't the planet, but it was the angel of that planet and the essences, the harmonic resonance of that planet. And the Jewish Talmud teaches that every blade of grass has a spirit coaxing it to grow. And the fairy, which is the all-embracing term for the divas, the naiads, the dryads, the different level, the fae or the fairy are receptive to humans who want to help, but they won't work with our anger. So fighting for planetary ecology actually cuts us off from the very helpers we need, because we need to work with these spirits. We need to strengthen them and infuse them with life force and joy, because by cutting down trees, we destroy the essence of the spirit, and that hopelessness spreads. We could probably have saved our country from Dutch elm disease if we had spoken to the elm trees and found out what it was that they needed. Working with fairy actually brings a mutual affection, and I have started experiencing this. It took a few years because I was completely rubbish at it to start with. But I talk to the divas from the trees every night in the darkness, because one of the things that people don't generally know is all tree spirits leave their trees at night, and they meet up in societies, in groups and gatherings, and that is the time that they will speak to us and listen to us. And one of your perennial homeworks from the end of this course is going to be at night time to talk to trees or to walk down a lane and observe them. And they love being named, because that's the legend about Adam. Adam could name the creatures and the plants, whereas the angels couldn't. That's why Lucifer was less powerful than Adam, because an angel can't give a name to something. And I find if I walk down the lovely lane, which has overarching trees just down from our house at night, they all come and they go, "Name us, name us." So I will give them names. I'll say hawthorn tree number one, hawthorn number two, larch, grey willow, bush by the side of the road. It doesn't matter that the names may not mean anything to us. They are received with such incredible joy that a human is giving identity. Now, a plant doesn't need identity, but it's a relationship forming, because when you have a friend, you use your friend's name. You maybe even give your friend a nickname. It's a sign of relationship. So if you've got trees in your garden, start naming them. If you've got pot plants, start naming them. Even if it's aloe vera one on the windowsill in my office, that's still a name. And oddly enough, it will respond, because even your pot plants have a little fairy, a little fae, who sits there and helps them to grow. So the companionship between these different levels of humanity and the creatures and the creatures and the vegetation and the vegetation and humanity is profoundly important in the healing of the planet, because the more of us actually identify with and speak to these beings, and to call them he or she or they, not it. It's much more difficult to chop down a tree when you know it's feminine or masculine and it has a name and you know that it has an essence to it. I don't think we're going to manage to stop the people who want to build a tunnel underneath Stonehenge in the United Kingdom, that even mining down underneath the the stones is going to damage the ley lines. It's going to damage the rock that's down there. Now, our planet is amazing. The ley lines will move and the energy lines will correct, but we should at least be telling them what's going to happen energetically. And in fact, a lot of spiritual people are starting to do that, to warn the land that these changes are coming. Because if you go out and you're going to do some clipping in the garden, if you can give a plant a little bit of notice, you'd be amazed how much differently it responds to being pruned. If you say, please draw your energy into your centre, I am going to prune you back, I'm going to cut you back so that your growth is stronger, the plant will do it, because the plant doesn't want to be hurt any more than we really want to hurt it. And quite often I find nowadays in the garden that the local overarching diva, because there always is an overarching diva for a land, the Japanese call them kami, little gods, nature gods, will quite often come across along and be really curious about what I'm doing, why some plants are pulled up and some plants are planted, because to her, it's all nature. So why am I doing this and why am I doing that? And sometimes it's utterly impossible to explain. But if I try, she helps me. And if I don't try, I'll get stuck with prickles or something like that. But if I communicate, the garden will assist. It will help me. Because love causes whatever it cares for to flourish. And also, love is more healing of pollution than being angry with the people who physically pollute. Because energetically, when we kick out at the driver of the 4x4, we're putting out negative energy that's just as bad as the fuel fumes that that car is putting out. So it's going against all our best interests to use resentment, passive aggression or anger to try and save the planet. Of course, righteous anger is going to come up. But the difference between righteous anger and holy anger is that holy anger does not wish to harm anyone or anything. It seeks to find a way to a resolution. Righteous anger will often get quite angry, would even hurt the people that you're trying to defend against. So appreciation, as we all know, attracts more things to be appreciated. So if we can work on appreciating nature, even if there are only a few of us doing it, really upping our game to appreciate whatever we see in nature, animal or plant or rock, anything, actually spreads more chi, more life force, and enables the planet to be stronger against our ravages. Because as nature is weakened, so are its spirits. And the spirits need our encouragement and our guidance and our belief that some of us are good, some of us are caring. We actually need to reassure nature that some of us still care. So let's have a quick look at the types of elementals. And the types, well, they are four basic types. They fit on the Kabbalistic tree of life, the four levels. We've got the fire spirits, the air spirits, the water spirits, and the earth spirits. And usually in the Western world, in Europe, they're known as salamanders, sylphs, undines, or gnomes. And they're all etheric. They're the interface between physical matter and the astral plane. They have a consciousness. They are totally amoral. That's not immoral. They're not bad. They don't do morals. They haven't got any interest in what a moral might be. Nothing is either bad or good to them. It's just what is done. They just do what needs to be done. And all of these are under the aegis of the diva of that area. So it's wise, if we want to start working with elementals or nature spirits, is first to address the diva of that land. And all you have to say is, great mother of this land, I salute you. And the essence of that kami or diva will attend to you. You can call her an angel, that's fine. We humans can perceive of angels far more easily than we can perceive of divas usually. Angels exist for buildings and things like that, but divas are only for the natural world. Every pebble and every shrub in the area covered by the mother of that area, that diva, is known to that mother. The phrase, not a sparrow falls, but God knows that. That means that the diva of the area is the representative of the divine for that area, and it is conscious of every aspect of life, even the life in a stone, which is the slowest form of life we know of. And also all the creatures and all the grasses and all the wildlife and all the trees and the plants are aware of their mother. The relationship of a mountain to its environment, to the landmass, its part and its effects on the winds and the rain and the erosion and the rivers are all part of that diva's role. They're all intertwined. And the diva's body, or believe if it's a mountain diva specifically, a land diva, it will extend below the ground. The diva's body will be a little bit like an iceberg, right down into the ground. And also it will tower above that hill. And through the vortices of its body, it draws up energy from the centre of the planet, which is where the salamanders come from, the spirits of fire. And it draws up energy and causes it to cascade out of the crown of the diva over that land in a living fountain of unifying life force for that land. And for us, the way to first contact these etheric beings, whether we want to try with salamanders, sylphs, undines or gnomes, is appreciation. Appreciation for the land, appreciation for the beauty. The easy way to start is just find a tree or a flower or a plant that you find appealing and just spend a little bit of time noticing what you appreciate about it. You know, touch, the feel of it, the scent of it, the shade of it, its shape. And you don't have to push for any special experience here. Just by loving it, you're weaving a connection with the essence, with the fairy of that plant. And that fairy, by harmonic resonance, will speak to all the other fairies of that plant all around the world, because they will all speak with each other. So if you find that you are particularly good at growing roses, well, yes, you are, because your love of the roses has spread. And if you keep saying, I can't grow anything, then guess what? You're probably going to be right. Oh, and I digress. Heston Blumenthal, who's a very odd and off-the-wall British chef who cooks very strange foods, is currently doing research with rice in water. And if you've ever heard of... I can't remember his name now, but I'm sure somebody will remember it and type it in for me, which would be kind. The man who did Messages from Water, a book where he checked out water molecules. He put water in glasses, and he was kind to one glass, told it it was beautiful and wonderful, and told the other glass that it was hideous and vile and ugly, and then froze them and then took photographs of the water crystals. And it was only the ones which were spoken to kindly that became beautiful. The ones that were spoken to unkindly became ugly, misshapen crystals. And Heston Blumenthal is now doing a similar experiment with rice in water, talking kindly to one pot of rice and cruelly to another pot of rice and ignoring the third pot of rice. And his findings so far are that the one you speak kindly to ferments beautifully and stays edible. The one you are unkind to goes off, but the one that really hurts is the one that has no attention whatsoever. That just goes mouldy. Really, really swiftly. So there's an important message there that even if we're communicating with spirit badly, it prefers us to communicate in some way rather than not communicate at all. So all our divas, all our land, all our angels come under the rose angel Anael, who's lieutenant of the archangel Haniel. These are what we might also call the essence of Gaia or Mother Nature. Haniel is the archangelic presence and Anael is her angel on the earth. And we'll be doing a meditation a bit later where we meet both of them. A few words about elves. Elves, of course, are very popular now through Lord of the Rings, and they frequently appear in Terry Pratchett's book. Terry Pratchett's got it down to a fine art with elves, and so has Tolkien, because elves are deeply amoral. And I don't mean deeply immoral, I mean amoral. Elves can be light or dark, but they do not care. They do deal with glamour. They love to be admired, and they will be of assistance to humanity if we deal with them with the correct discipline and wisdom and approach them with respect and reverence. However, they are not generally friends of humanity nowadays, because they're more complex than most of the elementals, most of the fairy. They have not free will, but they have complex emotions and thoughts, and they are capable of loving and hating in far more powerful ways. And they live in beautiful, powerful places. Elves are around all the great stone monuments, stone circles, places of great beauty. They do not live in cities or towns. You will never find an elf in a city. And that's because of iron. Iron is anathema to elves, because the energy of all of creation comes from the salamanders, comes from the heart of the earth, and from the light of the sun, and from the stars, and the light reflected from the moon. So fire is the source of energy. And once something has been formed out of fire into iron and goes cold, to an elf it's dead and repulsive. And you can repulse an elf with iron. Not that you're ever going to be attacked by a group of elves, but if you did, you would repulse them with iron. Tolkien didn't get that bit right, because his elves had to fight. But iron is of no use to elves, and they will run away from it. So you're never going to see an elf anywhere where there's going to be any iron. You're probably not going to see much evidence of elves as it is. They don't reveal themselves to us very often. So the life force of the planet, again, it comes up from the surface and down from the light. And that little picture on page 11, that very rather boring picture, is a picture I took in Japan of a shrine to a fox diva. The fox diva of that hillside. And they build these tiny little shrines with the beautiful red-orange gates for the life forces that they think need a little bit of help or support and happiness. And the local gods of the kamis are all respected. There will be, in most areas in Japan, there's a little temple for a hill, and within that temple are little shrines for the main creatures and the main trees of that hill. And they're given offerings, mostly offerings of papers or foods. It's all stuff that is biodegradable stuff. And in Japan, they absolutely understand about the kami, that there will be a hill kami, a mountain kami, a river kami, a lake, a sea kami, a forest kami. And they receive the chi life force and direct it through the web of life. So by greeting the kami or the diva, or talking to the mother of nature of where you live, and there will be a mother of nature in a city, wherever you are, because there are trees and there are gardens. If you talk to her, you strengthen her so she can draw more life force. So we will be working in harmony with them if we start to relate to them. So the divas are the architects of nature, while the nature spirits are the field workers and the construction hands. And that's from David Spangler, who is one of the primary workers at Findhorn. And Findhorn, up in Scotland, the Findhorn community is still thriving. It was started way back in the 1960s and 70s by three main people, Dorothy MacLean and Eileen Caddy and Eileen's husband, Peter Caddy. And they were all spiritual people. And for one reason or another, they basically ended up living in that blue and white caravan in the north of Scotland, in an area known as Findhorn, which really did not have very much good soil, very sandy, and they were living basically on a rubbish pit. But Dorothy, in particular, was very psychic, very aware of the spirits. And it was actually by 1963, right at the beginning of the 60s, she had this sensation to feel into the wind. And she couldn't work out what that meant. She thought it was an excuse to go off and enjoy walks in nature. But soon, where they were living, they were trying to cultivate a garden. They found that when they talked to nature, everything thrived. And both Dorothy and Eileen started talking to the divas and to the vegetables they were trying to grow. And they spoke to the smaller individual nature spirits, they talked to the bigger spirits, and they talked to the spirits of the clouds and the rain and the sun. And Dorothy particularly just went right into the glorious realms of nature where everything, she says, has soul and intelligence. And her first clear communication came from a garden pea. How wonderful is that? And that garden pea said to her that although the vegetable kingdom holds no grudge against those it feeds, humanity takes what it can as a matter of course, giving no thanks. And even if you're just buying food at the supermarket, if you can give thanks, you're actually strengthening the essence of the fairy of the pea. And I know this sounds a little bit vague, but it's so simple. It doesn't have to be hard, but it can be so effective. And what Dorothy realised was what we were just mentioning earlier. By speaking to one vegetable, she was speaking to the whole species of that vegetable. And Peter Caddy, being the more sort of academic of them, he started making a list of questions to ask different vegetable divas. And both Eileen and Dorothy would ask these vegetables particular things. And Dorothy said, we didn't have the slightest idea of what we were creating. And some of the other people who came to him, Findhorn, started seeing the elementals and experiencing them. And Findhorn just thrived. They don't have huge cabbages anymore, but they still thrive. And it's still a great centre for spiritual excellence. And one of the reasons why it's a centre of spiritual excellence is not only because of all the people who go and teach there, but because the founders and the people who run it explain humanity to nature. They tell nature why we behave as we do. They apologise to nature for our behaviour. And they've created a whole vortex of energy to support the planet. There are many other centres around the world that do that too. But Eileen, Dorothy and Peter talked to the nature spirits and begged for forgiveness and patience for them, telling them that the offending people were well-intended, just ignorant. And they even stopped a nature spirit strike at Findhorn. Apparently nature spirits got very uppity about something when somebody was cutting flowers in full bloom without permission. And the nature spirit said, you know better, we will withdraw our energy from you and everything will fail if you don't stop doing that. So they stopped doing that. It was perfectly okay to cut flowers if they asked the flowers. Now, some of you may be thinking that this is what I love to call wanky bollocks, but all I can suggest is you try it. Don't believe a word I say, just try it. Try communicating with nature. Dorothy McLean was once described as having an elfin mind and shimmering thoughts, so she clearly was talking with some of the shining ones. And one of the results of this is a book she wrote called To Hear the Angels Sing. So I recommend the book, it's lovely. And one of the principles of Findhorn they have on their website says, we bring the practice of collaborating with other forms of life into our daily activities in our kitchens, gardens and living spaces. Before each shift, we invite non-human partners, such as the plants we're tending, animals we're with and non-physical members of our subtle ecologies to work alongside us. This cooperation brings practical results as well as a more and connected creative relationship to life. And I suppose you could take it to the extent where you could talk to the ingredients of the supper you're cooking to ask them to help you. I don't know, I've never tried that, I just thought of it. I will give it a go tomorrow. And here's a message that was given to the Findhorn Foundation people by an ironwood tree diva. And it said, the doomsayers of your kind spread their messages, messages of consequences too terrible to contemplate. And so you do not contemplate them. There are allies awaiting the call to serve, a call that arises already in some of you. Let that call awaken new potencies, new alliances, and a new future. So successful ecological work can only be done with joy and love, not with anger and hatred, and creating relationships with nature are key. So how do you work with the divas? Well, in cities, you talk to the trees. Perfectly simple. Just be respectful. Don't run up to a tree and give it a jolly great hug without asking its permission. Honestly, a bit of politeness really helps. But if you relax around a tree, sit with your back to it in a park, and just be there. You don't need to try to communicate or anything. Just be there. And eventually, once it gets used to you and can trust you, it will reach out to you. All of nature will communicate with us if we're quiet, if we're still, and if we sit with them in silence and peace. And at dusk time, if you can, lie down on a patch of grass and look at the top of a tree and look past it and through it into the dusky sky, and you will see tiny flickerings of the tree's aura. You have to be patient to allow yourself to see this with peripheral vision, but it's there and it's showing you the etheric essence of that tree. And of course, if you have a garden, it's wonderful to leave it wild. We like to have wildflower meadows for bees, but it's even better for the divas because it means that they can dance and be riotous and not be totally tended all the time. And I like to offer libation to the nature gods. So whenever we have a bottle of wine or I've made elderflower champagne or something, I'll take a little saucer with some out to pour onto the ground to give thanks for the beauty of, and the joy and the sustenance and the hiccuping. And that's a lovely thing to do. And if you're lucky enough to have found your sacred space, which was your first ever homework, and don't worry, you've got the rest of your life to do it, visit as often as you can alone so that that diva of the area and all its spirits can get used to you and become friendly with you. It's best to visit your sacred area, if you can, at dusk, because that's when all the dryads are coming out of the trees, and that's when it's easier to see with the peripheral vision and to just see a certain amount of light or flickering. And the easiest way to do it is to perceive it, is to close your eyes for a bit, sit in stillness and silence, and think green. And I'm not making this up, just think green, visualize green. Green, 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 the green of grass, the green of leaves, every green you can think of, mottled greens, plain greens. Because by that, you are pulling yourself into the vegetable level and identifying with the essence of the elementals. You're going to catch them with your peripheral vision, not with the straight sight of your eyes. You're going to catch them more with your third eye once you're more used to doing that, but that's a whole other workshop. And if you offer blessings to the mother of that area, to the overarching diva, she will communicate those blessings to all the species there. So you don't have to bless them all individually. They'd love it if you do, but you don't have to. And the benediction I use is very simple. It's to say, Great Mother of this land, may you be blessed to the full extent that you may receive the benediction of the All Holy One, and may all your children and peoples be similarly blessed. And that's very simple, or something similar than that, to that, and it gets a response. You'd be amazed. Other things to do is to walk in nature at night by the light of the moon and name the trees and plants. Just go out at dusk. Be still or walk peacefully and just wait. Just wait and see what happens. Okay, so I'm going to stop the meditation now and... Not stop the meditation, stop